This evening, brethren and sisters, we are to have a Bible class entitled The Good Soldier of Christ for King and Country. And that I'm shortly to ask Brother Alec Fisher to give us that address. But by way of introduction, he has asked that we read the second epistle of to Timothy, chapter 2. So the second epistle of Timothy, of Paul to Timothy, chapter 2. Now it gives me pleasure in asking Brother Alec to address us on the subject, The Good Soldier of Christ for King and Country. Brother Alec.
Well, good evening, dear brethren and sisters. This is, in fact, part one of a two-part study. The expression, good soldier of Christ, occurs only in this second epistle that Paul wrote to Timothy. It was almost undoubtedly written from Rome when he was a prisoner there, facing almost certain execution. And this is evident from the words in chapter 4, verse 6, I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. The expression intrigued me, and I thought it might be advantageous to investigate matters a little deeper to see if there were lessons we could learn or consider in our service and allegiance to the Lord Jesus. So, for this evening, I want to say a little about the Roman armed forces, as the Apostle was acquainted with them, a little about the British armed forces, as we are acquainted with them, and then a little about the individual servicemen and the ethos to which they aspire. In the early Roman army, before the expansion to empire, the whole population was expected to be available for military service in some form, and recruitment was by annual levy. The soldiers were expected to supply their own equipment, therefore their status and career opportunities within the army was governed by their financial background. For example, since horses weren't cheap, the cavalry were drawn from the wealthier classes. About 200 BC, Rome flexed its muscles and acquired an overseas empire which necessitated a more regular army to fight lengthy wars of conquest and to garrison the newly gained provinces. Thus, the army's character changed from a temporary force based entirely on short-term conscription to a standing army in which the conscripts were complemented by a large number of volunteers willing to serve for much longer than the legal 6-year limit. These volunteers were mainly from the poorest class, social class, who did not have plots or property to manage at home, and were attracted by the modest military pay and the prospect of a share of war booty. Roman armies were always accompanied by units of non-Italian mercenaries, Numidian light cavalry, Cretan archers, Balearic slingers, who provided specialist functions that Roman armies had previously lacked. As a result of the social war in 91 to 88 BC, all Italians were granted Roman citizenship. Regular annual conscription remained in force and continued to provide the core of legionary recruitment, but an ever-increasing proportion of recruits were volunteers who signed for up to 16-year terms as opposed to the maximum 6 years for conscripts. From 30 BC, the republican system of citizen conscription was replaced by a standing professional army of mainly volunteers serving a standard 20-year term, plus 5 as reservists. Although many in the service of the empire would serve as many as 30 to 40 years on active duty, Legions continued to recruit Roman citizens, mainly the inhabitants of Italy and Roman colonies, until 212 AD. The regular annual conscription of citizens was abandoned and only decreed in emergencies. Legions were now flanked by the auxilia, a corps of regular troops recruited mainly from imperial subjects who did not hold Roman citizenship. The great majority of the empire's inhabitants until 212 AD, when all were granted citizenship. Roman citizenship. This is of special interest to us because of the apostle's claim to it. It was certainly advantageous to him as the apostle to the Gentiles. Luke shows him in Acts as a Roman citizen who, though a Jew and Christian, received, for the most part, justice and courtesy from the Roman officials, and more than once successfully claimed its privileges. He himself declared that he was a citizen of Tarsus. He was not only born in that city, but had a citizen's rights in it. The right of citizenship under the Roman government was granted by the emperor to individuals, and sometimes to provinces as a favour or as a recompense for services rendered to the state or for a sum of money. This freedom secured privileges equal to those enjoyed by natives of Rome. Among the most notable of these was the provision that a man should not be bound, scourged, or imprisoned without a formal trial. All Roman citizens had the right of appeal to Caesar. What we could not determine was whether this right of citizenship enjoyed by the apostle also imposed a liability on him for military service. Soldiers spent only a fraction of their lives on campaign. Most of their time was spent on routine military duties such as training, patrolling, maintenance. Soldiers also played an important role outside the military sphere. They performed the function of a provincial governor's police force. As a large, disciplined, and skilled force of fit men, they played a crucial role in the construction of a province's Roman military and civil infrastructure. In addition to constructing forts and fortified defences, such as Hadrian's Wall, they built roads, bridges, ports, public buildings, entire new cities, and also engaged in large-scale forest clearance and marsh drainage to expand the province's available arable land. Soldiers, mostly drawn from polytheistic societies, enjoyed wide freedom of worship. In the polytheistic Roman system, they revered their own native deities as well as Roman deities and the local deities of the provinces in which they served. Only a few religions were banned by the Roman authorities as being incompatible with the official Roman religion and or political subversive. Prominent among these were Druidism and Christianity. Military principles and practices have changed very little over the centuries, so we come to more recent practices. There is a noteworthy inscription at the base of Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square in London that epitomises the thoughts of the governments and military leaders relating to the armed forces of the United Kingdom, and this has been adopted by many other nations for their armed service personnel. That inscription: England expects that every man will do his duty. It was the signal sent by Admiral Horatio Nelson from his flagship HMS Victory at the Battle of Trafalgar, as the Battle of Trafalgar was about to commence on the 21st of October 1805. Trafalgar was the decisive naval engagement of the Napoleonic Wars. It gave the United Kingdom control of the seas, drastically reducing the threat of a French invasion and conquest of Britain. The significance of the victory and Nelson's death during the battle led to that phrase becoming embedded in the English psyche, and it has been regularly quoted, paraphrased, and referenced up to the modern day. Recruitment for the British armed forces was occasionally violent, and we recall from our history lessons at school the activities of the press gangs, which were well known for the physical force they used in recruiting men into the Royal Navy during the 17th and 18th centuries. It was, however, a practice which Parliament had first sanctioned several centuries earlier. In time of war, impressment, as the practice was known, was also a tactic employed by the army to acquire extra men, usually when the non-violent methods of the recruiting sergeants failed to enlist sufficient numbers. Naval impressment. The Crown claimed a permanent right to seize men of seafaring experience for the Royal Navy, and the practice was at various times given parliamentary authority. Impressment was vigorously enforced during the naval wars of the 18th century by acts passed in 1703, 1705, 1740, and 1779. The men pressed into service were usually sailors in the merchant fleets, but might just as often be ordinary apprentices and labourers. During the wars with France from 1793 to 1815, an impress service operated in British coastal towns. Although further laws passed in 1835 upheld the power to impress, in practice it fell into disuse after 1815. Army recruiting. During the 18th century, public perception of standing armies as instruments of despotic government obliged Parliament to keep Britain's peacetime forces as small as possible. There were times, however, when involvement in continental and colonial wars made it necessary for Parliament to legislate hastily for the speedy recruitment of vast additional forces. These extra men were raised either through voluntary enlistment or by compulsion. Recruiting acts were passed annually during the period 1703 to 1783, while the British Army was engaged in major wars in Europe and elsewhere. The acts offered a financial bounty or reward to men who enlisted for limited periods. In 1757, for example, the sum was £3. They also gave powers to magistrates to press unemployed but otherwise able-bodied men. We see then that conscription as we knew it in the early 20th century was nothing new. Thankfully for us, the British Armed Forces, with their highly sophisticated weapons systems, have no desire at present to forcefully enlist individuals who might well be reluctant and unreliable, preferring to rely on volunteers who have a serious interest in what they want to be involved in. But this could change, for instance, if this country should suffer serious civil unrest or even civil war, in which case martial law could take over, resistance to which would invite very unpleasant repercussions. The following are extracts from a military website which expresses the values and the standards required of individuals wishing to sign up. I wish to make it clear at this point, however, that there is a limit to which they could be adopted in our society, as I hope to point out in the next study. The reputation of the British Army is extremely high. This tradition of excellence and the public support it engenders depends, in large part, on the operational effectiveness of the Army that result from the high standards of professionalism, individual behaviour, and the self-discipline of the British soldier, both on and off operations. These qualities cannot be taken for granted and are only possible if they are underpinned by a robust and clearly understood framework of values and standards. It requires all of us to understand and live by them, and for all commanders, from the most senior to the most junior, to show emphatic leadership. Morale consists of many factors, including confidence in equipment, good training and sound administration, but ultimately it is the confidence between commanders and subordinates and between individual soldiers. Such confidence is a product of leadership and comradeship. High morale cannot be created overnight, but requires the forging of close bonds of professional and personal trust, which will withstand the stresses imposed by the demands of operations. It requires commitment and self-sacrifice, and to put the interests of the team and the task ahead, ahead of one's own. The military virtues are not in a class apart. They are virtues which are virtues in every walk of life. Nonetheless, virtues for being jewels set in blood and iron. They include such qualities as courage, fortitude, and loyalty. What is important about such qualities as these are that they acquire in the military context, in addition to their moral significance, a functional significance as well. The British Army is structured and trained for operations, not for the convenience of administration in barracks. On joining the army, soldiers accept a commitment to serve whenever and wherever they are needed, whatever the difficulties or dangers may be. Such commitment imposes a certain limitation on individual freedom and requires a degree of self-sacrifice. Ultimately, it may require, and does require, soldiers to lay down their lives. Implicitly, it requires those in positions of authority to discharge in full their moral responsibilities to subordinates. Selfless commitment is reflected in the wording of the oath of allegiance, which is taken on attestation. In it, soldiers agree to subordinate their own interests to those of the unit, the army, and the nation, as represented by the Crown. I swear that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and successors, and that I will, as in duty bound, honestly and faithfully defend Her Majesty, her heirs and successors in person, crown and dignity against all enemies, and will observe and obey all orders of Her Majesty, her heirs and successors, and of the generals and officers set over me. Irrespective of private beliefs, this oath embodies the context within which the British Army fights and operates. It expresses the loyalty of every soldier to the sovereign as head of state. These relationships find expression in the colours, standards, and other emblems of regimental and corps spirit. They derive from the sovereign. Personal commitment is the foundation of military service. Soldiers must be prepared to serve whenever and wherever required to do so, and to do their best at all times. This means putting the needs of the mission and of the team before personal interests. Discipline. To be effective on operations, the Army must act as a disciplined force. commander's orders carried out, everybody confident that they will not be let down by their comrades. Discipline is the primary antidote to fear and maintains operational effectiveness. It is supported by team loyalty, trust, and professionalism. Discipline instills self-control and breeds self-confidence. Good discipline means that all soldiers will obey orders under the worst conditions of war, and to do so with imagination and resource. The best discipline is self-discipline, innate and not imposed. The army expects self-discipline from every soldier, and training aims to strengthen it. Discipline requires clearly understood rules and a military legal system to enforce it. This discipline system must be fairly applied both on and off duty by all those in positions of authority. Integrity. Soldiers must be welded into strong and robust teams in order to achieve success on operations where individual needs and desires are subordinated to those of the team, however unpalatable or dangerous. Therefore, integrity has a unique significance to soldiering. It is essential to trust. Soldiers must have complete trust in each of their comrades, for their lives may ultimately depend on it. Integrity means being honest and truthful. All forms of deceit and dishonesty constitute a lack of integrity. They call into question whether an individual can be relied upon, damaging the team and therefore operational effectiveness. All commanders are responsible for defining and maintaining standards of personal behaviour in the army by example, direction and education. Integrity also demands that those who are in positions of authority at whatever level set the highest standards and are fair and consistent to their subordinates. A leader's example in personal behaviour is vital, and this responsibility increases with rank. Loyalty. Loyalty binds all ranks of the army together. It goes both up and down. It turns individuals into teams, creating and strengthening the formations, units and subunits of which the army is composed. The nation, the army and the chain of command rely on the continuing allegiance, commitment and support of all who serve, that is, on their loyalty. Equally important is that all soldiers and their families must be confident that the army and the nation will treat them with loyalty and fairness. The army's loyalty to the individual is expressed in the military covenant. It manifests itself in justice, fair rewards, and lifelong support to all soldiers. The army's standards. The values outlined above underpin the ethos of the army and contribute directly to achieving operational effectiveness. In sustaining these values, every soldier must strive to achieve and maintain the highest professional and personal standards. It is impractical to identify here every standard required in every aspect of a soldier's professional and private life. The Army's standards are designed to ensure that all behaviour is lawful, appropriate, and totally professional. Commanders have to understand the context and set out the standards in sufficient detail required by the situation. Clear communication on what is expected and why is essential. Officers and soldiers must avoid behaviour that risks degrading their professional ability or which may undermine morale by damaging the trust and respect that exists between individuals who depend on each other. For this reason, the army takes a different and more demanding approach towards certain types of behaviour and relationships that might, in society, be regarded as a matter of individual choice or morality and of no concern to the wider community. The service test. Individuals who fail to uphold the values and standards may be subject to disciplinary or administrative action. Unacceptable conduct requires prompt and positive action to prevent damage. Timely advice and informal action can often prevent a situation developing to the point where it could impair the effectiveness of a unit. A decision on what action should be taken and the extent of that action will depend on the circumstances of each case measured against the service test outlined. In assessing whether to take action, commanders must establish the seriousness of the misconduct and its impact on operational effectiveness, and in turn, the appropriate and proportionate level of sanction. In particularly serious cases, or where an individual persists with or has a history of acts of misconduct, commanders should consider the termination of service. Conclusion. The Army's values and standards demand a degree of commitment and self-sacrifice from officer and soldier which goes beyond that normally expected from other citizens. All officers and soldiers in the British Army are required to commit themselves to achieving and maintaining these values and standards. This commitment is essential to the ethos of the Army and continues directly to the maintenance of operational effectiveness. It is the duty of all commanders to ensure that these values and standards are accorded the highest priority, are fully explained to their soldiers, and are applied consistently. Commanders at every level must lead by example and encourage their subordinates to live by its values and to live up to its standards. To bring this part of our study to a close, we would like to make a few remarks about everyday life and events in the forces that the average recruit would be faced with. The first test that a new recruit faces is that of fitness. Military life is physical and very challenging, and any weakness in an individual would jeopardise the effectiveness of the unit in a combat scenario. Personal hygiene, tidiness, and presentation is of paramount importance. The uniform is provided and must be treated with respect and worn with pride. The sacred area of any barracks is the parade ground, and it is to this area that the new recruits present themselves for regular drill and training. What is taught here derives from the tradition of close order formation combat, in which soldiers were held in very strict formations so as to maximise their combat effectiveness. Formation combat was used as an alternative to melee combat and required strict discipline in the ranks and competent officers in command. As long as their formations could be maintained, regular troops could maintain a significant advantage over less organised opponents. The firepower of breech-loading rifles and machine guns rendered close formations in battle suicidal long ago. Modern armies still use parades for ceremonial purposes or in non-combat environments for their efficiency, ease of organisation and encouragements of discipline. Drilling increased in importance when men stopped fighting as individuals and began to fight together as units. A military drill is the memorizing of certain actions through repetition until the action is instinctive to the soldier being drilled. Complex actions are broken down into simpler ones which can be practiced in isolation. So when the whole is put together, the desired results are achieved. Such is necessary for a fighting force to perform at maximum efficiency in all manner of situations. However, depending on the army and the drills it adopts, drilling may destroy flexibility and initiative in exchange for predictability and cohesion. Recruits in most modern militaries are taught drill to teach them how to work and move as a team. In addition, formations are still used in riot control where melee combat is still the norm. The soldier will progress in his training by going on manoeuvres. This is an endurance test that is an obstacle course designed to challenge the physical and the mental abilities of trainees to work either as individuals or as a team to navigate around and through designed difficulties, and they may include mock battles with other groups. The soldier must fully, thoroughly understand the weapons at his disposal, and to this end he must be fully acquainted with each and every part, be able to dismantle, clean, lubricate, and then reassemble and test them. Well, we have not at this stage attempted any spiritual comparison, but I hope to be able to present some in part two on the 22nd of June when we consider Jesus our commanding officer.